Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today, we take you to the University of Southern Maine in Portland for a roundtable discussion sponsored by the Camden Conference. Five distinguished news editors ask, is the press fair to President Trump? Our panelists include Catherine Lee, city editor of Portland Press Herald, Walter Robinson, editor-at-large of the Boston Globe, Greg Moore, former editor of the Denver Post, and Keith Burris, editorial page editor of the Toledo Blade. Moderating today's discussion is Matthew Storin, vice president of the Camden Conference and former editor of the Boston Globe. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and a longer version of this program, featuring an extended introduction and more audience questions, will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. And as always, this program will be available as a podcast. Introducing our panel today is Betsy Mayberry, a board member of the Camden Conference.
Good evening and welcome on behalf of the Camden Conference. My name is Betsy Mayberry and I am a member of the board, the Community Events Committee, as well as the chair of the Southern Maine Initiative. Thank you for coming. Each year, the Camden Conference focuses on a topic of global concern. We offer a series of community events and college and high school courses related to this topic throughout Midcoast Maine and now in Southern Maine. It leads up to our annual weekend event, the conference. This year's conference, the 31st, is entitled New World Disorders and America's Future. It will take place on February 16th to the 18th at the Camden Opera House Live and will be streamed live to the Strand Theater in Rockland, the Hutchinson Center in Belfast, and for the third time to the Talbot Auditorium in Luther Bonney Hall at USM in Portland. We're very excited about it. And if we sell enough tickets, we may move it here. So I'll give you a heads up on that. The mission of all Camden Conference events is to promote informed and civil discourse on global issues. Community events are intended to provide information on our yearly topic and to touch on areas related to the February conference that may not be covered in our three-day event. The Camden Conference is a membership organization. It depends on the support of these members to provide events like this. I hope all of you will consider joining. Should you wish to do so tonight, there is material on the table in the back, or you can go to our website where there is a membership application as well. The event today, Is the Press Being Fair to President Trump?, is co-sponsored by the Camden Conference and USM, one of many of our collaborative efforts in Southern Maine. Before I introduce Matt Storin, our moderator, I would like to thank our global sponsor, R.M. Davis. These events would not happen without their support. I also would like to thank the Danforth Inn in Portland. They are taking good care of our speakers, including a nice champagne breakfast. I am now going to turn the event over to Matt Storin, Vice President of the Camden Conference and editor of the Boston Globe from 1993 to 2001. Matt?
Thank you, Betsy, and good evening to all of you. This is a nice turnout. And on behalf of the Camden Conference, I just want to add my thanks for your agreeing to participate in this event. And I say participate with emphasis because we look forward to your questions after the presentation. So please don't be shy. The other night at Harvard, I listened to a speech by Nancy Gibbs, who just recently stepped down as editor of Time magazine, and she noted in her talk, referring to President Trump and the press, We are watching something we have never seen before. She noted that in the country at large, the, quote, tribal furies are awakened. And we're here to talk about all of that tonight and to entertain your questions as well, as I mentioned. Before I introduce this really truly distinguished panel that has agreed to be here this evening, some of them from some distance, I'd like to show a relatively brief video that offers one perspective on all of this. And as they say in all the best places, it doesn't necessarily reflect the views of anyone up here.
During this disastrous Trump administration, when the country is reeling under full employment and the fact that you can practically order a cure for cancer from Amazon and have it delivered the next day, the nation's journalists have issued a new booklet of guidelines entitled How to Create as Much Hysteria as Possible from Acts of Violence That Are About as Likely to Kill You as a Bolt of Lightning Ricocheting off the Guy Next to You, then knocking over a tree that falls on a car and then flips over and lands on your head. The pamphlet, published by the Junkie Organization of Uninformed Rockheaded Oafs, or Journo, begins with a preface reading, quote, "In this terrible time, when the candidate we wanted for president lost because she was felonious scum, it's very important that every psycho who kills someone for some incomprehensible reason be turned into a major news event and then blamed on Donald Trump and the people who elected him instead of the felonious scum we loved so very much," unquote. The pamphlet then continues, quote, "Although it's true we can't make the entire country hysterical over nothing, because there are people with only a high school education who own dogs that are smarter and more realistic than we are, we should be able to spread panic in liberal enclaves where individuals with advanced degrees are already living in a fantasy world largely created by us in the first place. Since many of these jackasses live in Washington, D.C., their panic could cause real problems for everyone else, who will then panic in turn, and our goal will be accomplished," unquote. The pamphlet then goes on to give some rules for covering violent events in order to make them seem more threatening than they are and then blame them on Donald Trump. Quote, rule number one, some of you journalists may remember how Barack Obama made a speech about ISIS and implied that Christians were just as bad because they had fought in the Crusades. Some of you may remember how we praised Obama as a broad-minded leader for blaming both Muslims and Christians when only Muslims were to blame. Now, do the opposite of that. If Donald Trump responds to fascist violence by honestly pointing out that leftists are violent as well, accuse him of defending fascists and even of being a fascist himself. Rule number two, when Islamists commit terrorist acts, make sure to point out that all Muslims are not to blame. But when fascists commit terrorist acts, make sure to say that all right-wingers are to blame and all Republicans, and especially Donald Trump. Rule number three, Donald Trump can be boorish and inarticulate, and half the time no one knows what he's talking about, including him. Make sure to give his words the most obnoxious interpretation imaginable, and then pretend that what you said he said is what he really said, and then when there's an act of violence, blame it on what you say Trump said, even though he never said it. Finally, if you want to see these rules in action, you can just watch CNN, but of course no one wants to do that, unquote. Trigger warning, I'm Andrew Klavan, and this is The Andrew Klavan Show.
I think it's safe to say that President Trump would have approved that message. Now to our panel. Moving from your left to right, or is it? No, it's from your right to left. Keith Burrish is the editorial page editor of the Toledo Blade. His 30 years of journalism experience includes writing widely on politics, government, culture, and the arts, for publications ranging from Commonweal to the New York Times. He was named editorial page editor of The Blade in March of 2016. He served previously as The Blade's Metro columnist, and prior to this, for 21 years, he was editorial page editor of the Manchester Journal-Inquirer in Connecticut. While in Connecticut, he won the Alan B. Rogers Award for the best single editorial in any newspaper, regardless of size, in New England in a single year. Quite distinguished among journalists, he holds a PhD from the University of Pittsburgh and has taught at a number of American colleges and universities. And he's going to lead off, and I think I'll delay the introductions as each person is prepared to speak. So, Keith, the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks, Matt. The topic is the press fair to Donald Trump? The simple answer, I think, is no. I don't think we are, but I would sort of separate people who take that view from what we just heard, which was a sort of a cute press-bashing, glib piece of work that we have too much of that stuff already. I don't think, for example, that the press has overcovered the mass shootings, and I don't know of anyone in the press who's blamed President Trump for the mass shootings. But I think we're not doing a very good job of covering the president. I'm not worried about the president. He can take care of himself. He can hurt himself probably more than anyone else can. It's not the president who concerns me. It's us. It's the press. We've gone so crazy over Trump. We've gone so over the top. We've lost our perspective. We've lost our center and lost our way. It's not our job to judge President Trump. It's our job to try to understand how he got to be president and to try to help people understand what he's doing as president. A really great journalist by the name of Wallace Carroll, who was an old New York Timesman, worked with James Reston, told me once, you know, our function is to help citizens better understand their world. And I don't think we're doing that when we're so obsessed with the errors he makes or the silly things he says that we can't cover the government, the people he's appointed to run the national security apparatus, who are quite different from him. It doesn't help us to dissect the tax program that's just passed the House. We've really, I think, lost our way in a significant way. And it means that we're hurting ourselves as a profession, but we're also failing the country. We're not really educating. So I suppose we can debate the extent of this bias, or more interestingly, talk about where the bias comes from. I think there are two or three good reasons. But this is way beyond what we saw during the Nixon years. And yes, we're seeing something we haven't seen before, but rather than help people understand it and explain it, we're performing in a way that we never have before, with page one editorializing in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and the networks and the cable stations are a whole other story. So I think the crisis is really in journalism. The crisis of Trump is something we've got to try to help people explain and understand.
Thank you, Keith. Our next speaker, Catherine Lee, is city editor of our own Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. She was previously city editor at the Tuscaloosa, Alabama News, where she led a team of reporters to a Pulitzer Prize in breaking news in 2012 for their coverage of a deadly tornado. Prior to that, she served in reporting and editing positions at the Tampa Bay Times, Birmingham Post-Herald, and also at the Tuscaloosa News. She's a California native, so we're lucky to have her over this far east, and she received her bachelor's and master's degrees in journalism from the University of California at Berkeley. Catherine?
Thank you. I'm going to equivocate a little in my answer to the question of whether the media is unfair and say that many of the questions the press is asking of the current president are just the questions journalists always ask of people in power. Over the last couple of weeks, I've been thinking a lot about power, and it feels like there's a lot of parallels between the current political climate and our cultural one. We're at a time when we're questioning about just about everything about people in power, why certain people have it, how they use it, how that helps or hurts others. One unfortunate byproduct of this president is that he isn't used to it. This is a man who, for most of his life, has probably had people accepting what he says or does and not asking him to explain or clarify or justify. That's culminated in a presidency in which the media is the enemy, and that adversarial relationship has been standard operating procedure ever since. In one way, I think the Trump presidency has led to the sort of golden age of journalism, where we're seeing aggressive, hard-hitting work. We've been invigorated to dig deeper and cultivate sources to get information. We've seen reporters who dig tirelessly to dig into what the administration wants to keep hidden. I mean, think about what we wouldn't know about the president's finances if it weren't for David Ferenthal and his yellow legal pad. But I get that's not what it looks like if you're not a member of the media, if you're a reader or a viewer. It's exhausting to keep up with this constant stream of information, everything from the Russia investigation to the way Trump holds a water bottle. And that's led to more people distrusting what they read or see in the media than believe in our work. And when mistrust of government is at an all-time high, that bleeds over into a mistrust of the media. And that means everyone is sort of in a kill-the-messenger kind of mentality. President Trump's very deft at deflecting blame, and the media is an easy scapegoat. We ask rude questions, we're intrusive. If you support a candidate, the people who poke holes in your candidate aren't going to be your favorite people. You may like that he treats the press as the enemy. And when your candidate agrees with you and insists the media is targeting him, that just reinforces the idea that the media has it in for him. So if you support the president, I can see how you'd think the press is being harder on him than his predecessors. But part of the reason the press is hard on him is because he's a president who has acted in some unprecedented ways. So we've had to scramble to figure out a blueprint. I think where we do go wrong is in filtering out what's actually important to cover. We have a fire hose of information coming out of D.C. every single day. But in our efforts to be thorough, we regularly, and we still, run the mistake of elevating the trivial to the same level as issues that are clearly more important. We've seen stories about the size of Trump's inauguration crowd or how many electoral college votes he gets. Those issues certainly give us a glimpse into the mindset of the president, but they're not as equal value as analyzing his climate change policies, or how repealing a healthcare law will affect Americans, or how the tax overhaul will affect the middle class, or the travel ban will affect residents. We haven't gotten our arms around the difference between reporting an issue worth spending time on and reporting on how Trump has a weird handshake. How do we expect our readers to tell the difference if we're not helping tell them this is important and this other thing is just icing? So our job, first and foremost, in covering the presidency is to hold the president and his administration accountable for their actions. Most times that means being persistent about it to the point of sounding obnoxious. We're in a time where we're rightfully putting everyone who holds the levers of power under a microscope, and people should want a press that does that. Anything less means we're not doing our jobs.
Thank you, Catherine. Greg Moore, a native of Ohio, has held senior editing positions at the Cleveland Plain Dealer and the Boston Globe. I confess he was a colleague of mine for many years. Before being named editor of the Denver Post in 2003. During his tenure, the Post won 4 Pulitzer Prizes. A graduate of Ohio Wesleyan University, Greg is a former member of the board of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, and he served on the Pulitzer Prize Board, a very important and distinguished position for 9 years. Greg, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Matt. It's hard to follow the two previous presentations because they said so many things that I agree with. You know, as to the question of whether the press is unfair, I actually think that's going to be up to history to determine. I think doing it in a contemporary moment is difficult. I think it's difficult. But I will say, I think we're in uncharted territory. There's been a lot of commentary about how the president is sort of breaking with political norms. I think, you know, the media has broken with journalistic norms. There's no question about that. I have my issues with some of the press coverage. I think it's become too personal, too partisan, it's too uncivil, and it's really unbecoming, particularly for some of the big publications. When you're really trying to promote civility in our political discourse, to be so uncivil, particularly on the opinion pages, I just think that some of the commentary is beyond the pale, and that we're talking about things regarding a president that we've just never talked about. I actually read a story the other day that just flat out said, you know, is President Trump too mentally ill to have access to the nuclear button? They actually had a hearing about it in Washington. I just think, you know, there are just some things that, you know, you just shouldn't go there. And so I think we're in uncharted territory. I think that, for press that is really trying to help us sort of recenter our politics in this universe, that being super partisan, being uncivil, engaging in name calling, I think is really, really unbecoming. As to some of the news coverage, I think the Washington Post and the New York Times have been doing some really good work. I'm going to say that outright, and I know that there may be some people that are who would challenge that, but I think that some of the work that they've done has been really extraordinary. I have my issues with cable television, though. I think one of the things that is sort of fueling the mistrust of the media is the way it's presented on television, where, you know, you sort of have positional journalism, where you get someone that represents one side of the political spectrum who will tell you that it's dark outside when it's light, and somebody from the other side that will tell you that it's light, that it's dark when it's light. That's not journalism. And I think it just sort of feeds into the cynicism and the distrust of the media, and I hope we get a chance to talk about it and look forward to your questions.
Thanks, Greg. That last person on your right, I finally got that straight, is not the actor Michael Keaton, though he does bear a lot of resemblance. Walter V. Robinson, currently editor-at-large of the Boston Globe, led the Globe spotlight team from 1999 to 2006, most notably in its investigation of sexual abuse by Catholic clergy, for which the newspaper won the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service in 2003. The team's courageous reporting was the basis of the film Spotlight, starring Mr. Keaton as Robbie, the film that won the 2015 Academy Award for Best Picture. But long before he was that famous, he was White House correspondent for the Globe during the presidencies of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, served as Middle East Bureau Chief from 1990 to 91, and covered the Persian Gulf War. He also has served as a professor of journalism at Northeastern University, his alma mater, and Arizona State University. Robbie?
Thank you. Matt, very much. It's nice to see so many of my fellow millennials here tonight. And I want to thank Matt Storen. Hired me in 1971 when I was just out of the Army and didn't know how to write a sentence, and I thank him for that. And then he coaxed me into becoming head of the Spotlight team at a time when I was writing page one all the time with my own stories about looted Nazi art, that sort of thing. And I remember raising questions at the time, Matt, you know, is this really the right job for me? And I was thinking, you know, if I take this job, I'll never be heard from again. So anyway, I owe Matt a great deal of thanks for a career I might not have had. Thank you. And that's really all I have to say. No.
I like
just,
that.
You know, Greg Moore was my boss for many years as managing editor. I never, until this moment, have had an opportunity to correct him on anything. But someone to my right, your left, did say that there was a recent hearing even held into whether this president is mentally stable enough to have his finger on the nuclear button. I would only want to add to that that hearing was called by the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee. It's a little thing. Anyway, I was determined tonight to say absolutely nothing about President Trump. I brought my wide-angle lens with me, although I want to disagree with much of what Keith said, and we can get to that later. But, you know, I was going to talk about this subject just a few weeks ago, and I was trying to come up with examples of past presidents and their views of how horrible we journalists are. And I happened to be watching episode 6 of the Ken Burns series on the Vietnam War. And right in the middle of episode 6 is this wonderful telephone call that President Johnson makes to a reporter friend of his at the Washington Star. And this is what happened.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Hi, Jack.
We need guidance this morning, sir.
Is that all you want?
Yes, sir.
No quotation?
That's right.
No attribution? No connection?
Yes, sir.
Give it absolutely none.
Absolutely.
Your press is lying like drunken sailors every day. First thing I waked up this morning was trying to figure out, after seeing CBS, watching the networks, reading the morning papers, was how can we win, possibly win, and survive as a nation and have to fight the press's lies?
Yes, sir.
I'm trying to protect my country, and they're all whipping me. Not a son of a bitch said a word about Ho Chi Minh. They talk about us bombing. Yet these sons of bitches come in and bomb our embassy, and 19 of them try to raid on. All 19 get killed. And yet they blame the embassy. I don't understand it. We think we've killed 20,000. We think we've lost 400. We think that, of course, it's bad to lose anybody, any one of the 400. But we think that the good Lord has been so good to us that it is a major, dramatic victory. And I think what would have happened if I'd lost 20,000 and they'd lost 400? I ask you that.
Thank you, President Johnson, for reminding us that no president in, I'm looking carefully around the room for non-ogenarians, no president in our lifetime that I know of has had anything privately but disdain for the press that covers them. What's unique this time is that the vitriol is so public and, frankly, I think, so out of control, day in and day out. So I think, but in many ways, Trump's frustration with the press, much of which I think is his own fault, isn't a lot different than that of his predecessors. You know, last November 9th, I sent an email to a First Amendment lawyer friend of mine, expressing concern that the president-elect was a threat to the First Amendment. And I got a rocket of an email back within a few minutes that said, Trump is the biggest threat to the First Amendment since the Obama administration. And what he meant by that was that the Justice Department under President Obama used the Espionage Act 13 times to try and uncover the existence of whistleblowers in the government. And it was only because of public reaction against that that one of our colleagues, Jim Risen of the New York Times, did not go to federal prison. So this was a president, President Obama, who was dedicated to transparency in government. And speaking of President Obama, he ran a tight, leak-proof ship that it only leaked, really, when they wanted it to, because the people who worked for him and with him were so loyal that they didn't. They didn't dish very much to the press. This president is different because he has repeatedly shown his own disloyalty to the people who work for him. His White House is in such chaos that many of the people who work there are happy to pick up the phone and tell reporters about things that are actually really going on in there that are not fake news, though they are later labeled as fake news. by the president because he doesn't care for them. I'd also like to talk a little about reporters and ideology and how little, in the end, it matters. Reporters want good stories. I don't think for a moment that if Hillary Clinton had been elected president, that half the reporters who are now eagerly reporting for work every day would want to cover the White House at all. Because, you know what? Her relationship with the press corps was horrible. Was it her fault or their fault? That's not material. But her White House would not have been press-friendly, and it would have been a real chore to cover it. And a lot of the reporters whose names you now know, we all know, because they're covering Trump, they wouldn't be there. My view from having covered two White Houses, both Republican, is number one, over time, Republican administrations, excepting this one, have generally garnered much better press coverage than Democratic administrations, simply because they knew how to communicate better and communicate their message, and that reporters are in the game because they want good stories. And so their relationship and their view of the White House or the presidencies they cover, and this was certainly true when I was in Washington, is a lot less ideological than you think and a lot more transactional, that you want stories and you cultivate sources, and when they talk to you, you publish what they say. So I think I got through that without talking about President Trump. So I'll yield the floor
okay,
back.
Okay, thank you, Robbie.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. We're joining a panel of news editors at the University of Southern Maine for a discussion sponsored by the Camden Conference. Is the press fair to President Trump?
Just to add a coda to what you said, when I encounter a vociferous Republican critic of the press these days, and that's not too hard to do, I like to remind him or her that almost every bad thing we know about Hillary Clinton was first reported by the New York Times, whether it was Whitewater or the non-governmental email server or a bunch of other things. And I think that goes to the point that Robbie just made. I also wanted to mention that the guy that Lyndon Johnson is speaking to on the phone, Jack Horner, and I shouldn't speak ill of the dead, because I'm sure he's dead. He was almost dead when he sat next to me at Nixon press conferences, but he was such a pet of both, as I didn't realize till I saw this clip, Lyndon Johnson, but also Richard Nixon, and that is not easy to do, to be a pet of both, but Nixon always, he sat right here at the press conferences, and Nixon always called on him and never called on me as much as I tried, because he knew he'd get a softball question. So that's the flip side of some of what we're talking about. So I wanted to ask the panel, anyone who wants to take this on, do you think that Trump's baiting of the press very early in his, well, obviously during the campaign, but very early in his administration, calling them enemies of the people, et cetera, may have caused reporters and editors of mainstream media to overreact, or were they just motivated by in response to those comments? Anybody want to respond to that? So, this is a very aggressive panel. I don't know how to control them. It takes some mind reading, perhaps.
Well, I'll go first. I think the gauntlet was thrown down. I think the media took a little bit of the bait, but there was a lot of meat on that bone. I mean, there was just a lot of meat on that bone. And, I think they were motivated to find out, to fill in the blanks that Trump had left on policy, on his taxes, on his wealth, on a whole range of things. There were blanks left there. And I think that the fact that there was that meat on the bone, you know, really motivated the press to do its job even more aggressively. I don't think that led necessarily to unfairness, but I do think the level of questioning and reporting and things of that nature was amped up some. Thank you, Mr. President.
So a recent Pew Research poll revealed that 46% of the public think journalists sometimes make up stories concerning Trump. Now, I just want to say, for journalists, this would be like saying 46% of the United States Senate take bribes when they vote. I mean, I think that's how journalists would view this kind of comment. But a poll is a poll. Opinion is opinion. Where do you guys think this is coming from?
Fox News.
Could you be more specific?
Yes. First of all, the president, no matter what he does to himself or to others, maintains about 40% 40% support. And a colleague of ours, Ben Bradley, is doing a book on Trump, and he's focusing in on a county and a state I will not mention because I don't want any other reporter to scoop him on this. But he's astonished that when he goes to see Trump supporters, that Fox News is almost always on. So that explains 40 of that 46%. And the other 6% are people that we've written about who don't like the stories. No, I don't mean to make light of it. We don't always get it right. We make mistakes every day. Most of our mistakes, like most of yours, are sins of omission. We miss stories. Sometimes reporters' biases flow through. Why we have editors, although we have a lot fewer of them, is to stop us from publishing stories like, for instance, the Times story from Tokyo about how the president's daughter drew a smaller-than-expected crowd at some function that who cares about it? It was that kind of story. So there's always a good percentage of the American people who mistrust the press, and you know that's not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. We are fallible, and we need to be reminded of that, and maybe heighten our standards.
Anybody else want to comment on this? Keith?
I don't think it's a bad thing that they mistrust us either. I think it's probably a good thing. But I think the level of distrust is higher now because there's a sense, there are two things. There's a sense on the part of much of the public that we've taken a side. And I think that's a fair perception. I think it's so widely perceived because it's true. And the second thing is I think among sort of the deplorables, the lower middle class working people, the kind of folks we have in rural Ohio or in Toledo, people who were maybe worked for Champion Spark Plug and are now doing janitorial work, those people feel forgotten by what they perceive as the entire establishment, and that includes the press. And I think that's a reasonable and fair perception as well. I don't think the press is terribly interested in the Trump voter. I think much of the press views the Trump voter as Mrs. Clinton did. They must all be racist. They must all be dumbbells. And I think that, you know, I'm reading a really a beautiful book now by a guy named David Finkel on, it's called Thank You for Your Service, and it's about guys who went to Afghanistan and Iraq, some of them two or three times, And the thing that makes the book so beautiful is it's beautifully crafted, for one thing, but he embeds in the life of the sort of the Trump voter, the people who go to fight these wars, the folks, the forgotten, now under or unemployed middle class, and really there's a profound empathy with these folks. He not only is with them in war, but he follows them back to Kansas and spends time with them. And I think we never figured out as a profession the Trump voter. We sort of stereotype them, and if we're only interested in people like us, we're sort of not journalists anymore. We have to be interested in all sorts of people, including the poor white Appalachian driving his old beat-up pickup truck. So I think the distrust of the press has to do with we're so over the top, we're so alarmed by President Trump for some very good reasons, that we've sort of taken a side. And secondly, we never really took the time to try to figure out the Trump voter and understand what was going on there. That's not to say that he was or is the perfect representation of that person and that person's problems. But, you know, I took an Uber ride yesterday, and the young woman who was driving the car has a husband who was in the Navy. He was overseas in one of the wars. Two sons, both in the service, overseas in the wars. And she can't afford to live in Portland. I'll bet you dollars to donuts that's a Trump voter. And she's a very smart, intelligent, well-read, interesting person. So I think we need to get out of our bubbles and our echo chambers if we're going to do a better job.
Keith, in that context, and those are very good remarks, how would you explain the phenomenon of Fox News? What is your attitude toward Fox News? Robbie cited a very negative view of it. It's popular among many Trump voters. You have a good familiarity with the mindset.
Well, it's the center of that echo chamber. And you've got corresponding echo chamber centers on the left. I think the tragedy of the American electorate today, and also of the opinion side of American journalism, is that we've gotten ourselves in these little echo chambers where we only talk to each other. And the reader now reads for affirmation. You know, in the days of Walter Lippmann, you go out and get the paper in the morning, you want to see what has Walter Lippmann got for me today, because in that Wallace Carroll sense that I quoted earlier, you knew that Walter Lippmann was going to help you understand the world better. That's quite different from how we read most opinion journalism today. We read for affirmation. We know this writer is going to tell us what we already think and give us better reasons to think what we already think. And that's, I think, equally true on the left as the right.
Good.
Matt, can I?
Yes, Greg, go for it.
So I'm not 100% sort of sold on the idea that the media doesn't understand America. I'm not really sold on that. You know, a lot of our newspapers in this country, I mean, a lot of people think that the newspapers are the Washington Post and the New York Times, but for the papers that remain, they are distributed in small towns and medium-sized communities all over this country, and they actually do understand their readers, and they actually did write about, you know, the issues that they cared about and in the right context. I do think that a lot of the coverage is dominated by the CNNs and the MSNBCs and the Foxes. And the way that they do it is just, it's really not reporting and it's really not journalism. They rarely leave the studio, okay? they're part of the problem that is sort of fueling our politics. I think the problem is much more about our politics than it is our media. I really do, and that we need to be focused on it. I think a lot of the Trump phenomenon was the fact that, you know, Hillary and her folks really did treat that part of the country as flyover territory and didn't put the right resources in and that kind of thing, more so than it was the media, you know, driving either aspect of this. I heard this one interesting stat when we were all trying to figure out what the heck happened the day after the election. And somebody actually wrote that I think 70% of the people, 70% of the electorate had made up its mind about who it was going to vote for by Labor Day. So all those stories about Trump on the bus and all these other things about his taxes and all that stuff that had come up, people had already made up their mind. In fact, a lot of them had voted early in October. And so, you know, I'm just not so sure, one, that the media is as powerful as sometimes we say it is, and certainly that it's you know, out of touch with the vast majority of Americans, because I think they're writing about them every day as local news organizations.
I want to say a word to the audience. I'm going to keep asking some questions to the panel, but if any of you are moved at from here on to ask a question, there are microphones in each of these two center aisles. I encourage you to do so, and as soon as someone is standing there, as soon as we finish whatever we're doing here, we'll go to that questioner. What I did want to do, and this is repeating, continuing a little bit on the theme we're on now, you may have noted when I introduced Catherine that she has experience in Alabama. And we now are seeing in the news an awful lot about Senate candidate Roy Moore. And I think we would benefit from her experience down there. And then I see we have a questioner there and one here, so we'll listen to Catherine, and then we'll go to the audience.
Yeah. So I lived in Alabama for 15 years before I moved to Maine, and I have sort of kept an eye on Alabama politics, and I bet in the last week so have all of you. I think what's going on there is a combination of some pretty specific views about masculinity combined with pretty ingrained views of state politics and a deep mistrust of outside media. And for them, that means national media, Washington Post, New York Times. What didn't surprise me about what was coming out of Alabama and is still coming out is that so many people believe that even if the allegations against Roy Moore were true, they were still going to vote for him because they mistrusted the Post reporting even more. Now, I read that story. They waterproofed it six ways from Sunday. You know, they had 30-odd sources, women by name. They were very specific. But I saw a poll that I think it was 37% of more voters said that they were more motivated to vote for him because of that Post story. And I think it's because they almost saw it as a way of sticking it to the Post, like they were hurting the national media in some way. Alabama is it didn't matter whether he did it or not. And I think that's a deeply ingrained problem, that national media just can't get a toehold. In these flyover states, you know, the Times and the Post will come in, and even if those reporters are actually from Alabama, as some of them were, just the fact that they had the byline, the Times and the Post, by their names, made them less willing to trust. I think that Trump kind of gave them a blueprint to not believe the Post. He gave them the script. But that mistrust was always there.
Great. Any other responses here? So we will hear from the audience. This gentleman was first over here. And I would like to just ask you, you may make a brief statement if you want, but let's get to a question
sure.
Before too long.
I think you're onto something, Ms. Lee. President Trump's approval ratings are among the lowest of any president at this stage of his administration. Lower than those are those of Congress, and lower than those are those of media. So you're onto something, certainly. And media, much of media, according to several surveys I've read, they vote Democrat. 80-90% of Washington bureau people. And that's been true for decades. And so you all support each other. I don't know you. I don't know any of you personally, but that happens. And so and people out in the country, in rural areas, you know, the deplorables, they know that. They naturally, they distrust the Washington Post. President Carter opined about this recently. I'm surprised none of you brought it up. He said just a few weeks ago, I think the media have been harder on Trump than any other president, certainly that I've known about.
Question.
What?
What's
my question? What do you think of what I said?
You know, I would say this about polls, going back to the 19th century when there were none. There was a remark that has been attributed both to Disraeli and Mark Twain, and it turns out neither one of them said it, but it's instructive nonetheless. There are lies, there are damn lies, and then there are statistics. And I say that in reference to the polling because it is true that the president's favorability rating is higher than mine or my congressman, whose name is Bill Keating. But the fact of the matter is that when you poll, what do you think of your individual congressman, he or she polls much, much higher than the president. And whether we like it or not, when somebody does a poll about do you think the media makes it up or do you trust the media, they're asking, essentially, we're all lumped together. The New Yorker and Breitbart. Think of that. And people trust their own local news organization. That's a fact. The problem, I think, with the political discourse in this country is that, I hate to say this, we have too much media. But if you want to lower your blood pressure, watch the NewsHour on PBS, where both sides talk intelligently and without raising their voices about issues. If you want to raise your blood pressure, watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, because they're into drawing audience, and it's conflict and confrontation and shout-a-thons that draw audiences. And as Matt said, I think, earlier, they don't have real... Greg said. They don't have real reporters. I mean, they drag on reporters from papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post. And incidentally, when it comes to press bias, I think one way to change public attitudes is for editors of major newspapers to prohibit their reporters from going on these shows. Because you can't get off the air without offering some opinion. And I think that's bad for newspapers.
Yeah, and if I could just throw in another stat. You know, if you look at the cable news stations, I mean, their ratings are through the roof. Their advertising dollars, I mean, they're crowing about how much money they're making, more money than they've made probably in the last decade. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and certainly the Wall Street Journal, circulation is, you know, probably up, you know, 20%, 25%. And that's for a media that supposedly nobody trusts. So, you know, I just don't believe in the hype. I think it's really important for us to be skeptical about that part of it, too, because the stats don't bear that out.
Yes, Keith.
An additional reform. I'd like to put the genie back in the bottle on two things that started to happen in sort of the late 70s, early 80s, that I think were really destructive of journalism. One is that we started to interview each other on network shows, and then with the explosion of cable and cable shows, that became the basic format. Instead of a reporter at a convention interviewing Adlai Stevenson, two reporters talked to each other. So we became the story, right. We became the stars. And the second thing that I think was awful was when we started to we created this thing between editorials and hard news called analysis. And I'm sort of old school. I think in the period of American journalism, sort of 1900 to 1976 or 77, the golden period of American journalism, we had sort of the standard of, we called it objectivity, it was really detachment, but there was also this separation between news and opinion that was pretty strict. Usually the opinion editor reported directly to the publisher, and there was this sort of separation between news and opinion. And we created this thing called analysis, in which people started to write opinion on page one or in the A section of their newspapers. And then you can pick any day of the week a story on Trump off of page one of the Times, and the lead and the headline itself is an opinion piece. So I think we broke down that barrier, and it hurt the profession, so that some of the really great work being done by the Times and the Post, for example, like the uranium story, people don't see that work because they see the highly biased stuff on Trump. And so we're undermining, at a time when we need to show our countrymen that we're producing something different than the echo chambers or than people's blogs, we're undermining ourselves. I think the more serious thing is we're sort of not serving the reader, but we're undermining our own credibility. So I'd love to see us go back to sort of those strict separations, news and opinion, and I agreed, and no more reporters on Mary McGrory. Maybe she did it a little at the end of her life, but she never went on talk shows. She said, I write my stuff. So that's probably romantic.
All right, Catherine, and then I want to go to the question.
Analysis does have a place in trying to parse, you know, complicated issues like healthcare and the tax plan. I just don't think that cable news is the place to do it. Not when you have a segment. They're trying to fill 24 hours, and you have a segment that's a minute and a half. You can explain that tax plan in a minute and a half? No way. I think that it's just, I have CNN and Fox above my desk on the TVs every day. And I watch it with the sound off. But all I see when I glance up is six shouting heads on the screen. And it's too much. I mean, I think cable news is all about the visual. It's about easy graphics. It's about color. It's about spectacle. And I say this because I'm in print. And I think, you know, a newspaper or a news magazine does a much better job of breaking down what is actually important. We may not be doing that to the best of our ability right now because now we're thinking everything is important, but I really do blame cable news for kind of contributing to this sort of this atmosphere now where you have to have one opposing talking head and the other opposing talking head, and that's what your story is when that isn't what every story should be.
Question. 2 seconds.
Yeah, I agree with much of what Keith has said, but one thing I disagree on, and sure we make mistakes, sure some analysis goes over the top, but by and large, the reporting on this president during his campaign, the latter months of his campaign, and during his presidency by serious news organizations has been exceptional. And there's a lot that we know that we wouldn't otherwise know but for the really great work of investigative reporters who have really discovered the White House for the first time. I mean, the White House used to be a place where you went to have stuff dished to you. Now it's a place where serious reporting is being done. And a lot of things that we know about this administration that are true, that are not fake news, have been reported by serious news organizations and are not challengeable on the facts.
Okay, let's go to another question, and in the interest of time, shorter questions and shorter responses. Sir, thank you for your patience.
Yes, I hope you can help me with the dilemma that I have. I think the press also has. I am a liberal from up here, and my wife has had a reunion in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I look forward to going down there to talk to people who weren't like me so I could try to really understand what they were thinking. And in the beginning, I met somebody who I thought was quite bright and college educated and tried to initiate a discussion about where he was with Obama and other kinds of issues. What came back immediately, and this is more to you, Keith, came back immediately was, well, you know that Obama's father hated white men, and Obama is a Muslim. When it starts like that, I have no idea how to relate and talk to someone who isn't dealing with what I consider reality and facts. So this is in reference to what you were saying, Keith. How do you have a dialogue? How do you understand someone who might start like that? I realize that's not everyone, but it's probably a significant number of people.
I guess the question would be whether it is the significant number of people or a significant number of people. I think the person you're talking about would be pretty hard to reach.
Get over here.
Well, the only thing I would just say to that is there have been ignorant people since the beginning of time. But I think it's important to engage folks, right? Like, one at a time. When somebody that ignorant says something like that, hopefully you're in possession of facts that you can drop. I mean, that's what I do anyway. Is like some of the people that voted for Trump live on my street. They're my neighbors. I have wine with them on Friday, and it doesn't make them a bad person. All right, but you got to figure out a way to challenge that kind of stuff like in real time. And be able to do it in a way where you can still have wine next Friday.
Over here, question.
Can anyone offer a definition of what they feel fair treatment of a president by the press would be? And if so, can you point to a time or a place where it existed?
Was the question, has the press ever been fair to anyone?
No, basically, can we define that term, fair treatment of a president by the press?
I think it depends on who is asking. I mean, I would say any president would say the press treats him unfairly. I think as a member of the press, we would say, yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering what is fair treatment by the press? And has it ever occurred?
But when you're president of the United States and the leader of the free world and you think you're immortal and what you say is interpreted to be somewhat different than what you want it to be perceived to be, you're irritated at your press coverage. I mean, that's not just true of presidents. It's true of a lot of people. And we don't... When a president makes an announcement, when he's on message and the press chooses to cover another part of the issue, the White House gets irritated. So there's this constant tension. It's a good thing most of the time. I think it's not been so good this last year. But I think in the past it worked.
Sir, over here.
Thank you. People are bringing up the Nixon era a lot. This particular relationship with the press reminds me more of Dan Quayle, who was somebody you covered, and the relationship that they had. So again, it's not newly invented. But the question of the topic tonight is, you know, is the press being fair, and is this the way to cover a president? Is sort of an objective title, but we're talking about a particular individual who, as president of the United States, the New York Times printed a full page in agate, virtually the smallest type you can, of all the lies in the first 6 months of his presidency. And he's the guy who stands up at rallies and points out members of the press and says, this is a bad person, this is a liar, these are fake news. You know, that undermines our institutions. And so I'm wondering, doesn't the press have an obligation to cover this guy in a different way?
Like in a retaliatory kind of way, or? Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I think just because he points and, you know, calls names and stuff like that shouldn't affect how you do your job. It hopefully will energize you, keep you focused, make sure that you don't make a mistake. I mean, because the worst thing you can do in a situation like this is make a mistake, right? That which feeds into that whole fake news thing. You know, to go back to Matt's point, I think part of the reason that 46% of Americans are likely to believe that maybe, you know, the news media makes up stuff is because, as Robbie said, lots of mistakes get made. Like, I've been on the other side of news coverage, and I've seen the errors that have been in stories, right? So every person can take their own personal experience of having been, you know, misrepresented in a news story, misquoted, or left out a material fact, and just say, yeah, I'm going to let that play into the whole narrative that you can't trust anything. But I don't think that should cause the media to do its job differently or to put a little extra twist on the knife. I don't think that you should do it. I don't think you can afford to do it because it's that kind of, you know, taking your eye off the ball that causes you to make a mistake that could undermine everything that you do.
Go ahead, Robbie.
The presidency is an institution of extraordinary stature in American history. And we want to trust our leaders. And we've had good reason to do that much of the time with most of our presidents. And we're in a situation now that's unparalleled, where we have a president who constantly misstates the facts. I'm not going to call him a liar. I'm just going to say he gets it wrong so often that we need to focus on that. And I think it's right for the New York Times or any other news organization to keep track of and chronicle the lies, because our stature as a country is in jeopardy. And this is not a political statement. I mean, I've covered presidents, and I expect, and we all expect, civility in public discourse, particularly from our White House. And we haven't had that, and it's worrisome, and it justifies much of the in-depth coverage.
I think, yeah, I was going to say that I think what the questioner is asking, in essence, is this is a very different presidency. So the coverage is going to be different. It's not necessarily, you know, whether it's going to be fair or unfair. It's definitely going to be different. Yes, sir.
You know, I look at the demographics of our audience tonight, and I think it's safe to say probably the average age here is 60-ish or over. And we're here to listen to distinguished journalists like yourself or, say, a David Brooks, a Thomas Friedman. We read the Wall Street Journal, et cetera. My question is, what about the up-and-coming generation? Are they depending on Facebook and getting a lot of fake news from Russia? I'm kind of concerned, where are they getting their information to make their decisions?
They are getting it from Facebook. They're getting it from Twitter. They're getting it from untraditional sources. I mean, it's no secret circulation for newspapers has gone down. But I think it's our job then to figure out how to work in that sort of new world. I don't think journalism is in danger because we're dealing with social media now in a way that we weren't before. It's just we have to learn how to practice journalism in a different way.
I think journalism is in danger because I don't think people can see the difference between the social media and professionally produced journalism, and so it's up to us to make it clear what the difference is. The good news is that the Times and the Post, actually, their numbers are going up. Younger people, I think, are hungry for understanding. I just go back to that basic point that our I don't think our function is so much to be fair or unfair to a president or to treat him differently because he's different. I think our function is to try to explain what's happening in the world. And both the marketing numbers and polling data show that younger people will pay. You have to figure out the price point, but younger people will pay for content that is meaningful to them and helps them understand the world they live in, including this president.
I do think we're fortunate that we have Catherine on the panel. She probably brings down the average age of the room three or four years. Must have been a genius to put this panel together. Yes, sir.
Hi. Mr. Moore said that we may have to wait for history to determine. I wanted to plug a forthcoming book by an historian at the University of Texas in Austin called The Media Versus the Apprentice. And it is an historical work because it focuses exclusively on the period before the, you know, up to the election. And he shows in excruciating detail that in case after case, incident after incident, the press was misleading. And that's really the question regarding things that it, interpretations of what Trump said in incident after incident. Professor Martinez, by the way, was a Sanders voter and would have said says his preferred candidate would have been Elizabeth Warren. But I recommend people go check it out. You may rethink some of the things you think you knew about what Trump, you know, said along the way. I really recommend that book.
Do you have any example that you recall from?
Well, I think like the first article, I wasn't aware of this book, which is like 21 of 25 chapters are available in draft form online so far. But I read one article by Alberto Martinez during the campaign called The Media Needs to Stop Telling This Lie About Donald Trump. And it referred to the statement about in his campaign announcement speech about a subset of illegal immigrants from Mexico, which the press, you know, either stated or insinuated that he was talking about all Mexicans or all Mexican immigrants. And I think anybody that actually watched the speech would say, in general, when you're looking at his critiques of China or his critiques of Mexico, that Trump was criticizing our leaders more than he was criticizing people from Mexico. Anyway, I sort of just wanted to plug that book. It's called The Media Versus the Apprentice.
Okay. Thank you.
Maybe I'll just stop there. Thanks.
Any response? Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Thank you very much for a great presentation. Mr. Burris, I just wanted to remind you that when Hillary Clinton was speaking of the deplorables, she was referring specifically to racists, sexists, homophobic, xenophobic, and Islamophobic people. And I, for one, personally agree that people who have those beliefs are deplorable and don't agree necessarily with your kind of perpetuation of this false inference that Hillary Clinton was referring to these poor white guys out in the rural hinterlands. Let me just please finish. We're asking whether or not the media is fair to Donald Trump, who received billions of dollars in free press. He won the White House without getting the majority of the vote. He's a rich and powerful person who, in my view, we don't have to worry too much about personally, but what we do have to worry about are these people who believed him that the press is evil and now are going to be the recipients of these cruel policies that he's perpetuating on them, including tax cuts for the rich and taking away health care and the degradation of the environment. So my question, I think, is, I mean, do you think that the press was fair to Hillary Clinton?
Not necessarily. I think the question, again, would be, did the press help us understand her and her strengths and weaknesses as adequately as it could have.
And I would say no.
Sorry?
Thank you.
But I think the reason the statement got her in so much trouble is that she said that was the bulk of the Trump voter. So the
she said it was half of the basket.
Sorry?
She said it was half of the basket.
Oh, I don't remember it that way, but I think that's
well,
the,
like I said,
yeah, I think she did.
Facts matter.
I think the question is whether she thought or whether members of the press think that that's the only kind of Trump voter there is, someone who's in one of those categories. And I think that's sort of a trap that a lot of us have fallen into. Anyone who voted for Trump is one of those deplorable things. Those are deplorable things to be, but I don't think every person who voted for Donald Trump is a deplorable.
Oh, I absolutely do not either, and I hope the president is successful. Absolutely.
Okay, let's move along. I'm going in the order in which I saw someone waiting, and I think this young lady was waiting before
she
these
was.
Gentlemen.
I've had some trouble framing this question in my head because newsworthy news is newsworthy. But how do you as journalists and how can we as consumers think about where information comes from when we're thinking about stories about leaks and stories about revelations? I'm not thinking of Roy Moore's Washington Post conspiracy theory. I'm more thinking of the DNC leaked emails are as newsworthy as the fact that it was Russia who played such a big role in them being leaked.
Okay. Somebody respond to that? Robbie?
If the question was, where do we go to figure out who's telling us the truth?
How does the agenda of, how does where the information come from factor into the story itself? Like, how do you report that, and how do we read it?
Yeah, I think I understand what her question is, and it's really a matter of whether you are going to what we call mainstream media, and here I would exclude both MSNBC and Fox News, the kind of core news-gathering operations, whether it's the New York Times, NPR, PBS, whatever, because I think they, whatever their faults are, that they respond to conventional standards in news gathering. And I think this is true of many local newspapers, a point that was made by the panel earlier. And that some are really in the business of advocacy or ratings and internet clicks, and you've just got to distinguish among those different sources. Yes, sir.
Listening to this panel over the last hour or whatever it has been, I've gotten the impression that most, if not all of you, consider legitimate journalists to be those who work for organs such as the Post and the Times and the papers I'm sure that you all work for, and that what so many Americans, perhaps a majority of Americans, get their news from, the cable news stations, the online so-called InfoWars sheets, the Breitbarts, et cetera, are not journalism. I don't disagree with that, but if this country is going to be able to move forward in a reasonable and intelligent way, there has to be some way in which we can help people, certainly can't force them, but help people distinguish between truth and propaganda. I have no idea what that is, and I'm just wondering if all of you or any of you as journalists have any notion how to make those people who depend on propaganda organs for their information can be brought back to legitimate journalism.
It's a good question.
You know, we have a remarkably ill-informed electorate. Two-thirds of Americans can't name their own congressman. Daniel Patrick Moynihan once was challenged at a forum by someone taking issue with him. And he said, "Sir, you're entitled to your opinion. You're not entitled to your own set of facts." Because of this cleavage in our society, we have two sets of facts on most major issues. And if you toggle back and forth between Fox News, I just happened to be watching Sean Hannity the other night, and MSNBC, on the same issue, you could reach entirely different conclusions. It's not new that most Americans get most of their news from television, or now more than half of their news from their Facebook feeds. That's been going on for a long time. But it's also the case that most of the news or the television outlets you used to depend upon decided what they covered based upon what the major newspapers did, because the major newspapers have much, much larger staffs. I think a lot of people would be surprised, and I think probably people on the right would be appalled to learn how much other news organizations in the country depend upon the New York Times every day to decide what they're going to cover. Now, that's both a good thing and a bad, sometimes good, sometimes not so good.
I just say one very quick thing on that point that we got two things. One, we have to save the independent press, that because this model of, well, watch a little of right-wing cable news and watch a little left-wing cable news and split the difference won't work for exactly the reason we just, because you got two different worlds. So you can't find a middle in two different world perspectives. So you have to go back to sort of the traditional independent press that we developed over that kind of from the muckrakers to about 1980, 75, 76, 80. And the second thing is we have to teach civics in our high schools and even freshman year of college, because young people have, much of the country is ignorant because they've not been taught it. Young people have no idea how the government works, and we now have a president who has no idea how the government works.
Yeah.
I mean that's a real, really, a reporter at our paper, I said, well, has this bill gone to the conference committee yet? And it was in the state legislature. No idea what that meant. We have people voting and highly opinionated who don't understand the basics of the system. So we got to go back to teaching it in the schools.
The hour is getting late, so we'll restrict the last questions to the two gentlemen who are now standing. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I'm a lifelong militant moderate Republican. And
you're the one.
I worry and want your reflections, if you wouldn't mind, on is America in trouble? Because as you said, Mr. Burris, there's a fraction of the country that is engaged in thoughtful discussion and reading the newspaper, many of them instead listening to their morning dose of cable television. I worry that there is a movement afoot that threatens our democracy, that catches traction. And I sat through this election waiting for your colleagues in the news media to do what I felt militant moderates on either side had already woken up to, was that there was a very bad person who was ascending to the Republican nomination. Do you have the ability, do you think, as a fraternity, sorority, or collective, to be able to be out ahead of a movement that could, in fact, undermine our democracy and find ourselves in a position that it's too late?
Good question.
I'd like to think we do, but some days when I look at the landscape, I think what we need to do is to do what we do best, which is to do credible, well-researched news stories about matters of importance that hold powerful people and institutions accountable. But given the groundswell or the tidal wave of misinformation, I sometimes feel like that's like going to a gunfight with a knife. and I don't know quite what we do about it.
I prefer to take a more optimistic view that, I mean, journalism has taken hits before. This is just a particularly bad time, maybe, but it's not an unprecedented time. So I think the pendulum keeps swinging. It swung exceptionally far to the right, perhaps right now, but it'll swing back.
Yeah, sure. I just think, as I was saying before, I just think the sand is sort of shifting underneath our feet. You know, there are a lot of things that have sort of contributed to the state that we're in. Like, you know, people aren't really paying attention to mail-in voting. You know, that's really changing how politics are practiced, how you get messages out, you know, that kind of thing, where people get their information, how they get it. Some people want information pushed to them and that kind of thing. So I think, just to underscore the points here, it's the quality of the journalism that matters, and then we'll figure out the rest of that stuff, and I think the readers will figure it out too. Sometimes you have to have a seismic event like what we're dealing with right now to sort of figure out how you need to recalibrate things. And I think that's happening for journalists, it's happening for the electorate, it's happening for both sides at this moment.
I think one thing this election did was get people a lot more politically aware. They are reading more, and I honestly believe, I have friends with children who are young, they're 8 and 10 and 12, and they're paying attention at a very young age, and I don't recall thinking at all about politics when I was 8. And they are, you know, they grow up in a world where they are aware that there is so much social media out there, so much fake news, that they're learning to be discerning, and that's becoming part of the way they grow and learn. So I'm hopeful that, you know, this is not the end of democracy. It's just a course correction.
Good to hear a little optimism.
You know, the failing New York Times, as the president calls it, has gone from 1.7 million digital-only subscribers last November to 2.5 million digital-only subscribers.
And I'd also add, you know, one of the first phone calls the president tends to make when he decides to call a journalist is the New York Times. Even he believes in them.
Go ahead, sir.
I think I'm the last one, so I'll try and be as quick as I can with the question. I kind of undermining democracy is where my question is as well. When I remember during the Clinton era, CNN was the Clinton news network, and certainly now in the Trump era, Fox is the news network. And my concern and question to you is that when I look around the world to other countries, many of the more authoritarian leaders in those countries, one of the first things they do is to take over the press. Okay? They control the message. So I believe, yeah, certain people can say Clinton do it, Trump is doing it now, but now all of a sudden it's an attack as well on quote-unquote fake news, whatever that happens to be. So my concern is, I look at it and go, wow, is democracy really in trouble? Because when you all of a sudden only have one message, you don't even know which one is fact. You only have that one message. And I'm concerned that we're going in that direction.
You, sir, are a Churchillian figure. Winston Churchill said...
We will get them on the beaches. We will get them.
Yeah.
Winston Churchill said, "The free press is the unsleeping guardian of every other right that free men prize. It is the most dangerous foe of tyranny."
And on that note, I want to say that you've been a great audience. I have a feeling that many people in this audience did take civics in school, and that's why you're here. And I would just make, to try to sum up in like 15 words what we've been listening to, I would go back to a point made by Robbie early on, that politicians will never feel that they are being covered fairly. The real question is whether journalism is being fair to its readers and the public, and I guess we'll have to wait for history to make that verdict. Thank you very much for being here.
been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today we heard from five news editors who shared perspectives on fairness toward President Trump in the press. Camden Conference sponsored the event at the University of Southern Maine in Portland. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can listen to a longer version of this program featuring an extended introduction and more audience questions by accessing it on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to access the program along with many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. And for Speaking in Maine, I'm Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.